Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to catch up with a man who is observing and analyzing and otherwise contributing to our understanding of the war for the free world from one of its most important battlefronts, the Middle East. His name is Dr. Seth Frantzman. He is the founder and executive director of the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis. He also happens to be an op-ed editor at the Jerusalem Post and a writing fellow at the highly acclaimed Middle East Forum. I am very pleased to welcome him, I believe, for the first time to our microphones. Seth Frantzman, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Seth, one of the things that has been a focus of President Trump's visits to the United Nations General Assembly in the past few days has been Iran. He and his national security advisor, John Bolton, have really thrown down the gauntlet, not just with the Iranians themselves, but also with our European allies, who seem determined to help them, the Iranian regime, that is, persist. Something that's a bad thing for us in the United States, for sure, but also for Israel as well. I wanted to ask you about this parade in, I believe, the southern reaches of Iran, where Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps forces were attacked. You've written about this. Tell us by whom, and what does it suggest about the condition of the regime there, and whether propping them up is as ill-advised as it seems?
Well, this was a parade that was part of parades that were taking place across Iran as part of this kind of sacred or holy defense week that also coincides with 30 years since the Iran-Iraq war, in which Iran, of course, lost hundreds of thousands of people. So in this southern, or I guess it's southwestern city of Ahvaz, which is a city that's part of a province where there's a large Arab, mostly Shia minority, there was a parade that was going on, which included the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, I guess, as well as military band and all those types of things you would see at a military parade. And there was a reviewing stand there, and four perpetrators entered the parade, several of them at least wearing IRGC, it looked like uniforms, and then proceeded to machine gun a bunch of the people in the parade. And because apparently a lot of the soldiers in the parade, they didn't have clips for their weapons or ammunition, I think 25 people were killed and dozens were injured. I mean, when it comes to Iran, it's never always exactly clear, but the media released the names, I think, of 25. And most of them were men, or so they were either soldiers or guys that were spectating. But also there were some, I think, women and children that were wounded. So the interesting thing about the attack is that we don't know exactly who's responsible. ISIS claimed responsibility, as well as one of these small Arab resistance groups that basically is a dissident group that opposes the regime. So throughout Iran, you have all these different minorities, like you have Kurds and Azeris and Baluch, and all of them have groups that oppose the regime. Either they oppose it on religious grounds or ethnic grounds or different reasons. And many of them, of course, have headquarters or they have friends in Europe, for instance, where they basically live, because many of them escaped Iran in the 1980s or 90s. So I think the most interesting question is, okay, how did a group infiltrate this parade? It obviously shows that the IRGC was not prepared for something like this. It comes in the context of other attacks on the regime, especially in the Kurdish region. But the interesting thing is, if ISIS carried it out, because ISIS also carried out an attack in Iran last year, then it kind of changes the flavor in terms of, well, is this an anti-regime thing that's basically part of a minority group that opposes the regime, or is this an ISIS attack, which is something slightly different? And it could be that it's both, that it's some sort of group that opposes the regime, that also some of the guys joined ISIS and then decided to use this as a target of opportunity.
Fascinating. We'll be watching closely both your own writings at the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis and other evidence that's accumulated here, but it does seem to me it suggests a fragility to the regime that ought to be exploited, not alleviated. But let me turn to one other topic that you've also been focusing on, Seth Frantzman, and that is the agreement that was fashioned between the Russians and Turks concerning the Syrian region known as Idlib, that has involved understandings fashioned by the Iranians' friends, the Russians, and to some extent even the Turks. Tell us what you make of that and what it suggests is the future now for that long-suffering country.
The deal in Idlib basically covers an area that's quite large. It's the last area in northern Syria, where you have what's left of the Syrian rebellion. So you have a whole series of groups, but many of them are more hardline extremist or jihadist groups like this Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And obviously the regime and its Iranian allies in Russia would like to reconquer that area, whereas Turkey, which has been working with the rebels and actually has some observation points and forces in northern Syria, would like to stand by what's left of these rebel groups because Turkey doesn't want millions of refugees fleeing Idlib into Turkey. So because Russia is basically very close now with Turkey and the Syrian regime, they were able to broker this agreement, which is a Turkish-Russian agreement. So we see that Iran's not part of it. And I guess the question we'll have to look at then in the next month or so is whether or not Turkey can do what it's supposed to do under the agreement, which is to remove all the extremist groups from parts of Idlib and basically pull them back from the front line, and whether or not Syria and Iran will actually accept this, because at the end of the day, of course, Russia is a close ally of Syria and its air force is helping Syria. But, you know, Syria and Iran have sometimes, as we've seen, a different agenda than Moscow has. So for now, I think the agreement is in place. And I wrote a piece in The Hill, actually came out today, basically arguing that, look, America can learn from this because here you have some Russia and Turkey standing by their allies in Syria. And it's clear that America can learn from that in the sense that it can also drive a hard bargain in terms of standing by its allies in Syria or other parts of the region.
And just very quickly, it seems to me that we're rather short on allies in Syria. Of course, our most important ally in the region is the nation from which you hail, Israel. What specifically are you thinking about there? Is it standing with Israel as it faces this growing threat from Iran? Or are you talking about the Kurds or something else?
Well, Israel has its own policy in Syria, which is that it doesn't want Iran in any part of Syria. It certainly doesn't want weapons transfers to Hezbollah. And at the moment, that policy dovetails with the Trump administration, because under the Obama administration, it wasn't as clear if Israel had this kind of understanding or support in terms of this issue. So Israel had to kind of go it alone, and Israel had to work sometimes with the Russians to discuss some of this stuff. But it seems that the Trump administration and Israel are now on the same page. But I think the other U.S. ally in Syria is the Syrian Kurds and also their allies. It's part of the Syrian Democratic Forces in eastern Syria, which helped defeat ISIS. If it wasn't for that group, ISIS could still control a huge piece of eastern Syria. So I think when it comes to friends in the region, I mean, obviously Israel and America are close friends, but America needs other allies, and it would hopefully work with allies that are more moderate and allies that actually like America, which is, I think, the Kurds or the SDF are a good example of that.
Seth Frantzman, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I hope we'll be able to darken your door again soon. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk with her about the State of the Union, seen through the prism of the Kavanaugh debates and the deep state's revelations and more straight after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, one of the great minds of our time, I believe. She is a commentator, an analyst, a pundit, a commentator, a dissector of what is going on in our society, our culture, our civilization. And to talk about all of that in the context of what I think of as kind of the State of the Union, I think it's particularly important to have a woman who wrote a book on the death of the grown-up, which seems to be pretty much what's playing out at the moment, and also, of course, American Betrayal. You can find her writings in a more regular form at dianawest.net. And, of course, join us for our conversations with her here each week. Diana, it's so good to have you back at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about the Kavanaugh hearings that are underway as we speak. But more broadly, Diana, the state of our union or culture or civilization or society, as you wish, sort of seen through the prism of this drama that's playing out now in real time.
Yes, well, we're not in a fallen state so much as a shattered state. This is a crisis. We can't talk about the culture or the politics without talking about what is going on with Brett Kavanaugh. And it is indeed the drama in one man's life is really the story of our country writ large. You mentioned The Death of the Grown-Up, which is the book that I published over 10 years ago. And already all of the markers were in place in terms of looking at a society out of control in terms of judgment, standards, morality, and how that played out in the culture and, more importantly, in terms of our destiny as a nation in our politics. And to say things have gotten worse is, again, understatement also, but very instructive in the sense that this is what happens when there is no law, no order, no morality, where ends justify the means have crept in not just from the Marxist on the street corner, but are now right on the Senate Judiciary Committee, where we see the inversion of due process, of evidence. We see a media where ends justify the means has turned them into just carriers of garbage, not even pretending to practice the adult rules, yes, there were some, of journalism. Who, what, where, when, how. That's how it starts. None of that is happening because what we're seeing is this weaponization of instant gratification, which is one of these hallmarks of the death of the grown-up, in terms of wanting their political rush and seizure of power now, no longer even making the pretense that we might have seen even 10 years ago in process and so on. And it is come into this lurid, sordid event we are living through, where I try to think of ways to describe what we've been witnessing, and it looks like the wilding of Brett Kavanaugh, the wilding of our culture by a feral pack of legislators abetted by their various operative networks. I mean, this is a very serious moment where the political opposition to conservatives is not interested in politics any longer. They are going straight for the jugular. They say so. Their representatives talk about our politics, our religion, our beliefs, our traditions being acts of violence, and they are responding accordingly. And when you sort of look at the arc, if you will, of the death of the grown-up, you are looking at successive generations, really decade by decade, who have been inculcated in this emotional release in place of education, in place of growing up, in place of maturation, and just accelerate this, weaponize it, poison it, and this is where we are today. And again, it is a shattering moment because we were waiting for the adults to come in, and they're very few and far between.
Diana, you said something in particular that I just wanted to come back to because it has been so stunning, and that is the suspension of fairness, of civility, let alone due process in the effort to achieve these political ends. And I'm thinking particularly of the senator from Hawaii who has explicitly said that Judge Kavanaugh is not entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, because of his political views, because of his philosophy. So, I mean, this does seem to me to be a Rubicon that, once crossed, is, as you say, going to have the most profound repercussions for our republic.
Well, yes, and that's a very important point to go back to, because we have seen this before in history. I mean, this is a very totalitarian impulse where law does not mean anything except what the people in power want it to mean. And so you get away from objectivity. You get only to the deepest, most kind of obscene clinging to power, and by any means necessary. And I would say the senator of Hawaii, from Hawaii, Hirano, is exactly exemplifying the kind of belief and flaunting of it that we would expect at a show trial. We would expect a show trial judge to say that the accused has no rights because of his beliefs. And that is exactly what we're seeing played out. Not by the protesters, not by the people going into restaurants and being thuggish, trying to get out senators and so on, but people, senators, not just senators on the Judiciary Committee, where the most precious aspect, the underlying element of our whole system, is the presumption of innocence, that you have a chance to view the evidence, face your accuser. All of this is being inverted, and it goes back to something else that's even more important. These people don't believe in the democratic process. When President Trump was candidate Trump, he made explicit lists of the very men and women whom he would elevate, whom he would consider elevating should he have the chance to appoint high court judges, Supreme Court justices. And this was voted on in 2016. I mean, this was a big reason he was able to put the coalition together that put him into power, which included people who didn't like what he was about in terms of the America First agenda, but they were very happy with his legislative agenda. So we know that this was vetted. He had a mandate to do this. So that said, that means America wants a more conservative court. We're coming up to the five justices who can be considered on the conservative side. This is what they cannot take. They couldn't do it at the ballot box. And so this actually is why we're seeing this display, this hideous display of power politics. It is indeed to reverse an election.
Let me turn to another topic on which you have also thought and written profoundly, Diana West, and that is enemies within. And a sort of segue here is that Trevor Loudon, who was with me yesterday, was describing some of these characters in Congress in those terms. But I'm thinking in this case of people in the executive branch that are being outed by James O'Keefe and Project Veritas. And there are few people who have studied this subject more closely than you. It is the subject of your masterpiece documenting American betrayal going back to the 30s. Connect some of these dots for us in our own time, Diana. How are the insights of what you have covered and called to mind in that earlier period in which communists were, you know, riddled throughout the U.S. government, is a warning to our own time?
Yes, because one of the most fascinating things that I have gleaned from these amazing videos coming out of Project Veritas is the open admission of communist politics beliefs by these government workers, these people that you and I and the rest of the American people are paying to subvert our government from within, to overthrow it. That is what communism is about, is the overthrow of our government system. They're quite open about this and their beliefs and what they are doing to mess things up within sabotage policy. This is exactly what has been going on for about almost coming up on 100 years within our government, certainly beginning with the FDR administration in the 1930s.
Now, we should say, just a point of clarification, they're being quite open about it with somebody that they don't know is recording them. This is something that is being concealed from us more generally. It's going on. It's now being uncovered in a manner by James through these candid camera sessions where they are being, shall we say, careless to a point of transparency. And so anyway, what I wanted to get at, Diana, because not only have you documented the history of this kind of betrayal of our country and the lengths to which people have gone, mostly of the left, let's be clear, to conceal it, and to prevent people from being held accountable for it, But I'm also mindful at the very moment. I mean, again, the connective tissue between these is, I was listening to Hugh Hewitt this morning talking about that famous line that was used by Democrats against Joe McCarthy. Have you no decency, sir? This is a moment when the lack of decency vis-a-vis Judge Kavanaugh and the sort of appetite for power, the political warfare being waged within our government against our republic, and the criticism of any who try to ferret it out is so redolent of these earlier periods.
Yes. Well, of course, the have you no decency line was a complete con job, as our president might say, a complete setup that was completely misconstrued by historians ever since on purpose. Once you go back to the record and understand that there was absolutely nothing indecent about anything Joseph McCarthy was doing.
Diana West, we'll look forward to visiting with you in the aftermath of today's hearing in the days ahead. And thank you so much for your time today. Next up, Daniel Greenfield joins us. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a special privilege to say we are joined by Daniel Greenfield. He is one of the most Renaissance men I know, an extraordinarily articulate and elegant writer. You can find his materials at sultanknish@yahoo.com. But he also publishes with regularity under that byline at Front Page Magazine and Israel National News. He's the Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and just an extraordinary, well, national treasure, I think, in terms of his capacity to both understand and articulate challenges of our time, foreign and domestic. And it's always an honor to be able to pick his brains a little bit. Daniel Greenfield, welcome back. So good to have you.
Thank you. The honor is very much mine.
Well, let's see. I want to begin with, I think, some interesting analysis. There's, of course, a lot going on as we speak, literally as we are conversing. The Kavanaugh hearings are being played out on Capitol Hill. But you've done some research that I thought might be of note to our audience about the correlation between sexual abuse and Sharia supremacism, as Andy McCarthy calls it. And talk a little bit about some of the data that you've been looking at in Europe, in particular, Daniel Greenfield.
If you believe the Kavanaugh hearings, the greatest threat to women is prep school students. And that doesn't remotely reflect reality. It certainly doesn't reflect criminal convictions. And it doesn't reflect statistics as to where sexual assaults actually happen. So we've looked at the discrepancy in the treatment of Keith Ellison and Kavanaugh. And one interesting side note that I've lately been looking at in my research is sexual assault rates in Europe. So certain countries have surprisingly high rates. The United Kingdom and Sweden have very high rates. Other countries have very low rates. So what I've actually noticed is that sexual assault rates in a country track very specifically with Muslim immigration rates. Countries that have a high percentage rate of Muslim immigrants also have a high rate of sexual assaults, and it tracks very neatly. So, for example, Sweden has the second highest sexual assault rate in Europe. It's incredibly feminist. The Me Too movement is second nature there. This is a place where they once proposed a law banning men from urinating sitting down. This is a country where anything that smacks of sexism is immediately smacked down. So why does it have the second highest sexual assault rate in Europe? The answer is it also has the second highest non-indigenous Muslim population rate in Europe. And you have people coming from countries that are under Sharia law, where unaccompanied women are considered fair game. And a number of these rapists have actually said that in this country, their behaviors, in their home country under Sharia law, their behavior is completely acceptable. Belgium has the third highest Muslim population rate and the third highest sexual violence rate. The Netherlands are in fourth place for both. Germany is in sixth place for both. So these numbers are not a coincidence. They show the impact of Islamic supremacism, of theocratic attitudes on sexual assault rates on women. And while the left would very much like us to focus on Brett Kavanaugh and prep school students, the reality is that Islamic immigration is far more of a threat to women than prep school students are.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that the left would have us focus on men beyond those in prep school, but not so much those who happen to be practicing Sharia supremacism and are engaged in spousal abuse or other kinds of domestic assaults, perhaps because it is, by some accounts at least, obligatory under Sharia. It's certainly permitted, if not something you're commanded to do, to keep women in their place. So this brings us to Keith Ellison, of course, a man who is a Sharia supremacist as well as a Marxist, the representative of part of Minnesota and the United States Congress at the moment, aspiring to become the Attorney General of the entire state of Minnesota. And Daniel Greenfield, walk us through what seems to be an extraordinary double standard with respect to the allegations of domestic abuse by Keith Ellison from several women, as I understand it, as contrasting with the kind of attention that the left is giving, particularly, and the press, to Brett Kavanaugh's accusers.
Two women have accused Keith Ellison of domestic abuse. There have been police reports, there are medical reports, and yet largely the media has produced very unfavorable stories about the accusers, again, in contrast to the Kavanaugh case, and very favorable coverage of Keith Ellison. Now, the one question that nobody has asked Keith Ellison about is a very simple question. Are these accusations of domestic abuse a character flaw? Is it due to his own personality? Or does he actually believe that beating women is legitimate in line with the views of many Islamic scholars and thinkers who are easy enough to cite, who do indeed assert that abusing women is sometimes suggested and certainly prescribed as a kind of last resort? And when you consider the fact that Keith Ellison is running for a position that will allow him to administer law in an entire state, how can women feel comfortable and safe with a man who may very well believe that abusing women is something that a man has a right to do?
Yeah, or at the very minimum is an advocate for a code that either commands it or certainly is permissive of this kind of abuse. It's a very legitimate public policy issue, it seems to me, and one I salute you, Daniel Greenfield, for elevating. And let me turn to another topic that I know you've been wrestling with, and that is the so-called peace process, Daniel, specifically that is supposedly still going on, though there's not much evidence of it 25 years after Oslo, between the Palestinians and Israel. And President Trump yesterday, in press availability with Bibi Netanyahu, spoke rather effusively, once again, of the so-called two-state solution being kind of the ultimate end objective of this peace process, and that his administration will be submitting a plan for getting there sometime in the next 2 to 4 months. Put this into context for us, just as a reminder of how successful this process has been to date and whether there's any hope of it succeeding in producing something in terms of genuine, enduring peace if it is going to result in a so-called Palestinian state as part of that endgame.
The term peace process is a misnomer. Not only has there never been any peace at any point in this process, in fact, the violence has increased, the insecurity has increased, not only for Israel, which has been forced to actually send its population into bomb shelters in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in the previous conflict, but furthermore, there is no actual process at this point. The process hasn't been in place for quite some time. When John Kerry and the Obama administration attempted to resume the process, they were so unable to secure the cooperation of the Palestinian Authority that effectively the Kerry team negotiated for the Palestinian Authority with Israel. And when they brought the results of their negotiation to Abbas, who heads the Palestinian Authority, he rejected them. That's exactly how absurd this process has become. So there's no peace, there's no process, which means this entire thing has always been a giant waste of money, and it's also a giant waste of lives. Quite a few people on both sides have lost their lives in an attempt to create a Palestinian state, which absolutely nobody wants. The bottom line is that the Palestinian Authority has shown no inclination that it actually wants a separate peace with Israel. What it wants is an endless conflict with Israel, because its donors, its backers, whether it's Qatar or Iran, want an endless conflict with Israel. They have no interest in actually ending the conflict and creating peace, which means any process that is based on the notion of a Palestinian state is always doomed to fail. And that's what history has shown us. Now, President Trump has very vitally discarded some of the tactics and methods of previous administrations. Every previous administration believed that it had to pressure Israel to make concessions to the Palestinian Authority in order to secure a two-state solution. The Trump administration has broken with that very toxic received wisdom. Instead, it's begun pressuring the Palestinian Authority, and the Palestinian Authority, for its part, has made it very clear that it is now more unwilling than ever to actually entertain any thoughts of peace. So the Trump administration can release a peace plan, but the problem is any peace plan is based on a fallacy. It's based on a false notion that the Palestinian Authority wants a two-state solution, that it wants peace, that it wants any kind of final settlement. It's made it very clear that it does not.
Yeah. Other than arguably the destruction of Israel and the conquest of the place by the Palestinians and their friends. And let me just ask you about this, Daniel, in terms of what the president seems to be suggesting he intends to do as a next step at the conversation that he held with Bibi Netanyahu in front of the press yesterday. There was much made of the importance, and I want to salute him again for making the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the capital of the State of Israel. But he said, this is a big chip. And he gave that one to Israel, and now he's going to demand from Israel a big chip that he will be giving to the Palestinians to somehow facilitate this deal that he is going to be proposing in the next few months. Just put this into, again, context for us, Daniel Greenfield, as you see it, the idea of making transactional concessions here in the absence of that fundamental commitment to peace on the part of the Palestinians seems to me to be a fool's errand at best, and reckless if not worse.
It's reckless, it's a fool's errand, and it's also been shown repeatedly, and we're talking about now nearly a quarter of a century, that it absolutely will not work. It's never produced results, never, not one single time that it's been tried, which means it should absolutely not be tried again. What President Trump was elected for was his willingness to throw out all the old received wisdom, all the old failed policies that don't work. This is very much a failed policy that does not work. The United States has no national interest in rewarding terrorists, even if this were to work. But the fact is, we're not only rewarding terrorists, again, to our own harm, but we're rewarding terrorists for a policy that still does not actually even work.
We have to leave it at that. Daniel Greenfield, so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, David Goldman joins us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. David Goldman is in the house, I'm pleased to say, at least virtually. He is, of course, the man best known for his extraordinary writing and the Asia Times, done under the pseudonym Spengler. But he's also the author of a terrific book, How Civilizations Die, and a frequent guest here, we're very pleased to say, and always glad to have him, especially when there's some very important topics that I'm anxious to pick his brain about. David, welcome back. It's good to have you.
My great pleasure, Frank. Thank you for having me.
One of the things that I have on my mind, and I think probably is on yours too, is the rather robust defense of U.S. sovereignty that Donald Trump made in his remarks before the U.N. General Assembly this week. Talk a little bit about what he said and its importance, as you said.
Oh, as we all know, in the post-war period, the United States sponsored a set of international institutions as a way of rebuilding the world after war and defeating communism. These included the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, NATO, and so forth. And since the fall of communism, these institutions have turned into a vehicle for free riders and deadbeats to exploit American resources and American goodwill for their own purposes without contributing anything.
And globalists to sort of dictate more broadly, have they not, to policies and sovereignty-sapping initiatives?
They become a parasitical nest for globalists who want to tie our hands in terms of our own actions. So President Trump has simply called the question on this. He's refused to let the United States be tied down by multilateral trade agreements, which he believes are unfair to us. He's demanded that our European allies, such as they are, contribute their fair share to defense. And he served notice on Japan and others that will insist on adjustments to our trading relationships and tariffs and so forth. It's extremely bold.
We ought to add to that litany, though, as well, the rather direct challenge to a number of the UN institutions and more broadly sort of the whole idea that it can tell us what to do. No?
Well, there are many such examples. So I think the president has really cut the Gordian knot of globalism in a brilliant way. It's one of the most difficult and complex transformations that any leader has ever attempted on the world stage. And as you would expect, the president is very successful in some areas, not entirely successful in others. He's taken on a gigantic number of problems simultaneously.
He has indeed. One of which was front and center at the UN, particularly in his presiding at the UN Security Council yesterday, is Iran. And you mentioned our so-called European allies. It's pretty clear that they are dead set, as are the Russians and Chinese, of course, to perpetuate the Iranian regime. I spoke earlier in the program with Seth Frantzman about this. Talk a little bit about how the president is faring in that effort at the moment, David Gold.
Iran is a terrific success story. The Europeans have complained about it. They've set up a mechanism to evade American sanctions by permitting European companies to conduct payments to and from Iran through a special purpose vehicle created by the European governments. That will have very limited effect because in any important area of trade, particularly oil trade, everyone knows if they do business with Iran, they can't do business in the United States, and there are very few entities of importance in the world that will take a trading relationship with Iran and for it sacrifice their relationship with the United States. That's what's called secondary sanctions. So the Iranian economy is imploding. It was going down even before we unilaterally repudiated the Iran nuclear agreement, which I wholeheartedly support repudiating. But now it's in free fall. And as President Trump said, they've got riots all over the country. So I think Iran is on the ropes. The United States versus Iran is no match. That's a little punk little country, tin pot dictatorship, and we have enormous leverage against them. So that's a terrific success story, and I think that's going in the right direction.
Well, we hope that the Europeans and the others will be unable, as you say, at the moment. They certainly seem to be to countermand what the president is trying to do there, because I personally am convinced that, as I think you are, that regime change is the only way, really, to avoid the kind of catastrophe that President Obama was enabling with a nuclear-armed Iran bent on the destruction of places like us and Israel.
Absolutely, I agree.
Let me ask you about one other thing. You've written at Asia Times about the Chinese stealing a march on us with the help of the Europeans, to the possible fatal detriment of the U.S. auto industry. And I'd like to talk to you about both what has happened in this context, but more broadly, what is the future of the automobile manufacturing sector worldwide?
Well, in terms of growth of demand, non-Japan Asia is going to be the great auto market of the next 25 years. The Chinese alone will buy at least 500 million vehicles. The Chinese are also, in many ways, the center of innovation. self-driving cars work well only if you build new cities around the concept, and that's what the Chinese are doing. They don't work particularly well in, say, Tempe, Arizona, with its lousy infrastructure. And electric vehicles, which the Chinese are keen on, are extremely important, and that will probably almost certainly be the great market for that. So the German and Japanese auto companies have accepted Chinese invitations to do joint ventures with both their automakers and their battery companies. Daimler, Benz, and Volkswagen, and so forth, are in that trade massively. And a trade war with China over tariffs, which encourages our so-called allies to use the opportunity to get into the Chinese market at our expense, isn't necessarily going to have a good outcome for us. I 100% support the president when he calls attention to the Chinese threat, but I simply think the tariff regime he's employed is not the most effective tool, and it could blow up in our faces by allowing our so-called allies to work with the Chinese behind our backs.
Let me ask you, though, drill down just a little bit on this. When you talk about the Europeans moving into the Chinese market, is it not absolutely predictable that they too will find in the not too distant future what our companies have found, which is that essentially the Chinese have ripped off their technology and will be essentially cutting them out of that half a billion car market? Maybe not immediately, but in due course.
They're making a gamble, but the Europeans and Japanese are in demographic decline. They're trying to fund their retirement. They can't do that at home because their workforces are shrinking. So they need to invest overseas to find the people who will pay their pensions in the future. And that's their gamble. They have a very different kind of long-term interest than we do.
No, I get the long-term interest. I guess what I'm thinking is it's unlikely to work out for them, probably even in the middle term, let alone the long term, simply because the way the Chinese operate is to expropriate the technology and then dominate the market themselves, often with the designs of their erstwhile competitors. But let me ask you one other question about this, David, because you're such a thoughtful guy. You mentioned electricity as kind of the way of the future. I've been fascinated for some time about the possibility that we could turn the immense amount of natural gas, possibly coal too, but natural gas for sure, and maybe other products, into an automotive fuel, not by having natural gas-powered vehicles, but by turning those sorts of products into methanol. I just wonder whether it makes sense for a country like ours, with an automotive industry built around liquid fuel, of which we have an abundance, it turns out, especially if we're able to make this methanol, ethanol, and gasoline mix operate as fuel choice, if you will, rather than compete with and become dependent upon the Chinese, who are increasingly moving to dominate both electric car technology in general and battery technology in particular.
Well, there are a number of ways we could use natural gas. There are also reasonably sound technologies to turn it into ammonia and burn ammonia as a fuel in motor vehicles.
A fascinating topic to which we will return with you shortly. I appreciate so much your time today. David Goldman, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.